Welcome to the KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. In this episode, we have stories on a legal settlement concerning the Great Redwood Trail, sea level rise complicating the Humboldt Bay Area Plan, and the Humboldt County Growers Alliance celebrates its 10th anniversary. But first, some local alerts and updates. This is KMUD News. Starting off with news for the Fieldbrook Redwood Forest in Humboldt County. Prescribed fire practitioners plan to burn 6 to 22 acres starting as soon as tomorrow, September 9th, if weather conditions permit. The prescribed burn has been planned carefully for more than 5 years by the Pacific Forest Trust in partnership with the nonprofit Torchbearer, with support from the California Wildlife Conservation Board and the State Coastal Conservancy. This project's goals include increased resilience of permanently conserved working redwood forest ecosystems in the Fieldbrook Valley, the restoration of large fire-adapted trees, enhanced wildlife habitat, and improved community protection from extreme wildfire impacts. Torchbearer's burn boss, Scott Steinbring, who holds both the state and federal qualifications to lead and implement prescribed burns, is on the ground assessing weather and fuel conditions. If weather, fuel receptivity to fire, required firefighting resources, and legally required smoke and burn permits align, Fieldbrook residents could see smoke rising from the forested area southeast of Fieldbrook Road and Cider Mills Road this week, or possibly later this fall. From Humboldt County Public Works. The Humboldt County Department of Public Works will continue working on the surface removal and resurfacing project on Elk River Road in Eureka on Wednesday, September 9th through Thursday, September 10th. Work began on Friday, September 4th, and due to unforeseen circumstances, the project schedule has been extended. Work will take place at three project locations between Zanes Road and Wrigley Road. Contractors will remove the existing roadway, repair and rebuild the base, and finish with a new layer of asphalt. Work will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Travelers are to expect 15-minute delays and are asked to drive slowly, follow all traffic control devices and road signs in the project area. If you have any concerns or questions regarding this project, please call 707-445-7421. From the Bureau of Reclamation. A new chapter for Trinity River salmon begins this fall as the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and Hoopa Valley Tribe bring separate fish monitoring and harvest operations together at one jointly operated location. The Bureau of Reclamation joined its partners today to celebrate the milestone with a ribbon-cutting ceremony recognizing stronger collaboration, more efficient monitoring of Trinity River restoration efforts, and reduced stress on salmon when they are migrating upriver to spawn. Starting this fall, CDFW and the Hoopa Valley Tribe will collaboratively conduct Reclamation's run size estimation activities at the tribe's harvest weir, rather than at separate monitoring locations further upstream. Working at a single location allows partners to continue collecting critical information on Chinook salmon, coho salmon, and steelhead while reducing repeated capture and handling of migrating fish, streamline monitoring, and reduce costs for reclamation. This approach continues to support selective harvest activities at the Hoopa Valley Tribe's existing harvest weir on the Hoopa Valley Indian Reservation. Reliable monitoring helps fisheries managers track returning salmon, measure progress towards restoration goals, and make informed decisions about restoration and harvest management. Reclamation helped bring the parties together to reach an agreement that allows this work to continue within the Trinity River Restoration Program Partnership. CDFW has estimated Trinity River coho salmon run sizes since 1978, using mark and recapture methods at monitoring weirs in the lower and upper basin. CDFW and the Hoopa Valley Tribe have worked cooperatively on monitoring efforts since the 1990s. For the Hoopa people, fishing with weirs has a much deeper history. Hoopa people have used fish weirs and other fishing methods on the Trinity River since traditional times. In 2016, the Hoopa Valley tribe began operating a modern harvest weir on the Hoopa Valley Indian Reservation, where the tribe selectively harvests fish, including fish used to support its tribal elders program. The ribbon cutting marks a renewed commitment among Reclamation, CDFW, and the Hoopa Valley tribe to work together for the Trinity River and the people and fish that depend on it. By bringing monitoring and tribal harvest together at one location, the partners are building on decades of cooperation while supporting salmon restoration, fisheries management, and the continuation of tribal traditions. From the Eureka Police Department. At approximately 8:17 a.m. today, Tuesday, September 8th, Eureka Police Department patrol officers responded to a motel in the 1300 block of 4th Street for a report of an individual threatening suicide with a firearm. Due to the nature of the call, officers from EPD's Community Safety Engagement Team and mental health clinicians from Crisis Alternative Response of Eureka responded to assist. These officers and clinicians are trained in crisis negotiations. Upon arrival, officers and clinicians established contact with the individual by telephone. After more than an hour of communication and negotiation, the individual agreed to exit the room and was safely detained without further incident. That individual was then transported to a local hospital for additional care. Over the past several weeks, EPD has responded to two separate incidents involving individuals who died by suicide using a firearm. The loss of life in these circumstances is devastating and can have a lasting impact on families, friends, community members, and the first responders who respond to these incidents. If you or someone you know is struggling or considering suicide, help is available. You are not alone. Here are some resources. The Crisis Alternative Response of Eureka can be reached at 707-441-4044. For the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, call or text 988. For Humboldt County Behavioral Health, call 707-445-7715. And for the Veterans Crisis Line, call 988, then press 1. And up next, our main stories. This is KMOD News. Planning for sea level rise is proving to be a challenging task for Humboldt County's Planning Commission. Daniel Mintz reports.
Workshopping policies that will shape the future of Humboldt Bay, the county's Planning Commission couldn't reach consensus on how to handle sea level rise. At its September 3rd meeting, the commission held a third workshop on the draft Humboldt Bay Area Plan, and the review included five scenarios for sea level rise. There's uncertainty on how to plan for it as it hinges on a variety of factors, including future degree of emissions reduction. A high-risk scenario was in a previous draft of the plan, but the categorization is brought down a notch in the current draft to intermediate high. Planning Director John Ford explained the rationale for that.
The reason we went away from high, and I think it's right there on the screen, is because there's a 0.1% chance that it would ever be exceeded. And so that is kind of a very, maybe an unrealistic chance that it would happen. Intermediate high itself has a fairly low chance of ever being exceeded. As I recall, that's at 20%. And so intermediate high is still a very conservative projection.
The plan's supporting documents include federal sea level rise projections, but some commissioners, including Commissioner Lorna McFarlane, are concerned about planning for uncertain outcomes.
They are always going to support the more drastic. I guess coming from another place, we have pushed back on that because the higher the scenario, the more cost associated with building that adaptation. And that's so far out in the science, the uncertainty drops so much that you're potentially adding, in some cases, millions of dollars to a project for some threat that may or may not be realized.
While some commissioners supported going with the higher scenario, They acknowledged the challenges of forecasting, and Commissioner Todd Fulton questioned the basis for the forecasts.
I personally don't think that the science is there for the immediate high. I'm more comfortable around the medium area, not only for the cost basis, but I personally don't see the science that justifies the immediate high.
Commissioner Jerome Kiriazzi said he leans toward the higher category, but wants more information. Commission Chair Sarah West summed up the commission's situation when she said, quote, "I personally am not going to be able to follow this well enough and look at all the areas to be able to make any sort of substantive decision about it tonight." Commissioners agreed to table the sea level rise review and return to it later in the process. They also agreed to include residential high-density zoning in the plan, a category that had previously been omitted but was vouched for during a public comment period. Commissioners also heeded a call for zoning to be evaluated through an environmental justice lens, as stated by Amy Jester of the Redwood Region Climate and Community Resilience Hub. She said the aim would be to, quote, "identify and avoid, minimize or mitigate disproportionate impacts to disadvantaged communities, existing and planned affordable housing, tribal cultural resources, and culturally significant areas." Commissioners agreed to consider enhanced environmental justice language in the future. With the workshop phase done, the Bay Area Plan will move into a public hearing process starting at the Commission's October 15th meeting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Six property owners just won a $1.4 million settlement, and their attorney says there are roughly 200 more property owners along the Great Redwood Trail, which runs through our backyard, who may qualify for compensation, KMUD News reports.
A group of California landowners along the Great Redwood Trail just won a major legal victory, opening the door for hundreds more in our area. Six property owners between Willits and Arcata recently received a $1.4 million settlement from the federal government after arguing their land was taken for the trail without fair compensation. The case centered on century-old railroad easements, rights the railroad held to operate across private property that were converted into public recreational trail use once the rail line was abandoned back in 2022, under a federal law that allows old rail corridors to become public trails. Landowners argued that conversion amounted to a taking of their property that the government never paid for. We spoke with attorney Megan Largent, who represents landowners in this case and leads the federal takings and rails-to-trails practice at the law firm Lewis Rice. She's worked on rails-to-trails compensation cases nationwide, including here along the Great Redwood Trail Corridor. Largent says the vast majority of pending and unfiled claims are right here in Humboldt County, concentrated around Arcata, Eureka, and Fortuna, rather than farther south.
The federal government is the sole party named in the lawsuit that's liable. And so we filed these claims, like I said, in the United States Court of Federal Claims. That court has limited jurisdiction. It can only issue money awards against the federal government. We could file in the Northern District of California in the federal court there, but that judge, any judge there would be limited to $10,000 when awarding money damages against the federal government. So that's why we file them in D.C. But no, the Great Redwood Trail Agency is not a defendant, nor any local entity, no railroad, nobody associated with the trail. Not only are they not a defendant, they simply couldn't be. This court wouldn't have jurisdiction over them. Again, they only award money damages against the federal government. And that's an issue that was settled a long time ago when Trails Act litigation began in the 90s. Federal government did try to point its finger at the trail group and say, you know, why are we left holding the bag and not the trail group? And the court said, well, it's the federal government that has put this in place. This order allowed this transaction to occur. And, you know, what it really accomplishes for the federal government, what the goal really is to preserve the federal government's jurisdiction over this so that they can implement another railroad at any point in the future if it wants to. That would trump the trail use. Of course, that's extremely remote. That's why trail groups are willing to invest the money and time in developing the trails, because railroad use does seem so remote. But the federal government's interest here is that they get to keep jurisdiction over this line. In other words, they control a strip of land in California they would otherwise have no reason to control because it's not an interstate commerce anymore. So they keep that in the National Railroad Network. A long way to answer your question is yes, it is the federal government, only the federal government, that is liable.
That authority traces back decades to a 1983 law meant to keep the country's shrinking rail network intact.
It was from 1983. They passed the Trails Act, and there's these rail trails all over the country. Some of them are fantastic trails, but the whole point of the law was Congress was concerned about our railroad infrastructure nationally was shrinking at a rapid pace, and they wanted to preserve this infrastructure. And so the idea is the federal government can keep all these lines available for future use, but while no railroad has any interest in it whatsoever, they can be used as these public parks in the interim. So they call it interim trail use.
As for the settlement itself, the $1.4 million wasn't split evenly among the six landowners.
It was six owners. You know, it's not distributed evenly. So it's based on their particular piece of land and how this taking affected it. So I will say there's one owner among the six that received the lion's share of that money because they were acutely affected by this. You know, not only was a large strip of land of theirs appropriated for trail use, but it affected access to their property in a pretty dramatic way. Owners' compensation depends entirely upon how this rail line crosses their property and how much property it uses. Not all of our owners, in fact, hardly any of them will have identical compensation because it's based entirely upon their individual piece of property.
Largent's firm has three other cases in various stages with the Justice Department. She cautions that a settlement is never guaranteed. Different attorneys and judges could reach different outcomes, and every case stands on its own. The clock is ticking for anyone who hasn't yet filed. The original order allowing the rail line's abandonment was issued in October 2022, starting a six-year statute of limitations that runs out in October 2028. Largent says the firm tries to reach affected landowners directly. Mailings, informational meetings, up and down the trail, including recent stops in Fortuna and Eureka, and a website with FAQs and videos. But she admits it's an uphill battle. The law doesn't require anyone, not the government, the railroad, or the trail group, to notify landowners of their rights. Courts have ruled that publishing the original order counts as legal notice, even though many people never see it or mistake the mailings for junk mail. So, if you own property along this stretch of the trail and think you might be affected,
they should reach out. They should definitely reach out. Not everybody who has property on the rail line has what we would call a good claim. It goes back to how the railroad was created over their property, and that's research that we've done in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But we're always, if anybody calls us and they're not sure, we look it up and, you know, we can tell them, yeah, it looks, you know, our research shows that you would have a good claim, or our research shows that you wouldn't. And then, you know, that's it. Then they know. So it's very arbitrary feeling to people now in the 2000s that their property right, you know, their entitlement to compensation is determined by decisions made back in the turn of the 20th century in the early 1900s when those landowners gave over certain rights to the railroad. And so if they gave the railroad an easement to operate their trains, then they have the owners today have a claim for compensation. If the owners gave up the land itself, though, they don't. And that's my research shows we still have 200 owners along this line who I believe the railroad only has easement rights and they have not yet made a claim. So I would encourage owners to reach out. You know, I know personally if they call our office, we will tell them right away whether our research shows that they have a good claim or not.
And whatever you think of the trail itself, Largent wants one thing made clear.
I mean, the only thing I never want to end an interview without mentioning is that this is not against the trail. Nothing in our lawsuit is aimed at stopping the trail, impacting its funding. It will not impact the trail's funding. Any money paid to landowners comes out of a pot of money called the Judgment Fund that Congress appropriates every year to pay the debts and liabilities of the United States. So, you know, it is whether you think the trail is a good idea, a bad idea, or you're ambivalent, this case really has nothing to do with the trail. It has everything to do with just ensuring that the property owners who are going to host it are treated fairly. And, you know, the way the law is that their best day in court, their absolute best day in court, they walk out with fair market value of their land. You know, so there's no punitive damages or multipliers. I mean, it's, you know, a claim for literally the fair market value of what was taken from them. So it's not a windfall. You know, it's not sort of ill-gotten gains or anything like that. And it's not anti-trail.
Landowners with questions can reach the firm through railstotraillslaw.com. Reporting for KMUD News, this is Bridget Carstensen.
The Humboldt County Growers Alliance is pivoting the organization's goals as the trade association celebrates its 10th anniversary, KMUD News reports. The Humboldt County Growers Alliance, also known as the HCGA, is celebrating its 10th anniversary. The HCGA is a trade association of Humboldt County cannabis growers who advance the interests of legal cannabis businesses across the county. Detailed in a press release this week are some serious changes the organization is making to help it better adapt for the next decade of the Humboldt cannabis marketplace. Namely, the HCGA is looking to fill more than the role of a traditional trade organization and expand into helping build a marketplace for Humboldt County's high-quality cannabis. HCGA Board Chair Hannah White stated, quote, "For 10 years, HCGA has fought to protect and establish a regulatory space for Humboldt cannabis businesses. The next 10 years are about making sure Humboldt wins in the long term. We are proud of what this organization has accomplished, and we are ready to build on it. Market development is the next era of cannabis association work for our members, and the HCGA is ready to lean into it." End quote. Recent market expansion for the HCGA include the 12 Jays of Christmas calendar and helping to bring Humboldt cannabis businesses more high-profile appearances. Recently, that included the 2026 California State Fair and its Cannabis Awards, where Humboldt County growers and makers claimed 25 total medals, including 6 gold, 9 silver, and 10 bronze across 10 categories. The most awarded category at the fair for Humboldt's cannabis was for categories involving sun-grown flower. Notable local farms recognized at the 2026 California State Fair included Huckleberry Hill Farms, Canna Country Farms, Vesuvio Gardens, and Bryceland Forest Farm, among others. The HCGA aims to take competition and publicity successes and turn that into a broader vision of transforming the role of cannabis in Humboldt's economy. The organization stated a desire for cannabis, agriculture, culture, and outdoor recreation to work together to strengthen the county's destination identity. According to Hannah White, quote, "We have an opportunity to tell a bigger story about this place and the people who make it extraordinary. Cannabis belongs in that story, and we are excited to have a seat at the table." End quote. Time will tell if the HCGA's reorganization and renewed focus on better integrating the story of Humboldt cannabis into our local economy will pay dividends. The years since Proposition 64 and legalization in 2016 have been hard on Humboldt, and especially Southern Humboldt's economy and its once dominant cannabis industry. Cannabis sales within Humboldt County itself currently are growing at a slow pace based on Prop 64 consumer cannabis excise tax collection data from 2025 and the first two quarters of 2026. All of those quarters had a 15% cannabis excise tax for consumers, except for quarter 3 of 2025, which had an excise tax rate of 19%. For example, in Eureka itself, tax revenues from local dispensaries grew from just over $3 million in the second quarter of 2025 to around $3.15 million for the second quarter of 2026. State tax revenue data showed similar growth results for dispensaries in Arcata, where for quarter 2 of 2025, around $1.69 million of consumer excise tax was collected. versus $1.74 million for quarter two of 2026. Unincorporated areas of Humboldt County also saw minor increases in cannabis tax revenues. While that data is limited, it could be a sign that our local cannabis marketplace is no longer in decline. Although reliable data and trends for the entirety of Humboldt's cannabis industry, especially for sales outside the county, is hard to ascertain. It is also important to remember that local dispensaries in many cases sell product produced outside of Humboldt County itself. It's a long road back for Humboldt County's cannabis growers and makers, but if the Humboldt County Growers Alliance achieves its goal of building new marketplace opportunities for Humboldt's cannabis industry, hopefully sustained growth is in store for future quarters. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Bianna Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporter for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz, along with our assistant director, Bridget Karstensen. KMUD News is now on streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located in the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyut, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.